whilst we're on the topic of so-called classical music, Sheffield Labs, which was a label 10,000 years ago, used to cut what's known as direct-to-disc.
Oh, you'd see, now we're getting common ground. And welcome back to Not an Audiophile, the podcast. This is episode 21, season 2. Today we're speaking with David Carrazza. He is assisting myself, Andrew Hutchison, with a tricky discussion on music. And it's always tricky, and that's why we've avoided it, because it's ultimately just someone's opinion. This episode of Not an Audiophile is sponsored by StereoNet. Are you looking for your tribe? Visit StereoNet.com today to join one of the world's largest online communities for hi-fi, home cinema, headphones, and much more. Read the latest news and product reviews, or check out the classifiers for the largest range of gear on sale. Membership is absolutely free, so visit StereoNet.com and join up today. David Carrazza is back. This is Not an Audiophile, and on this fine hungover Sunday morning. No, the morning's not hungover.
Yeah, and nor am I.
No, you're a clean living type, and I'm an idiot. So, music. We haven't spoken of music about it. We haven't made recommendations. I think I made one recommendation once, only in 20 episodes. Many people have said, what is it? You're talking about hi-fi, but you never speak about music, which is the reason hi-fi exists. Yes, it is. I'd love to talk about music, but there's reasons why I don't. And I'll let you explain why you don't, or maybe why you want to, David. I just think it's personal taste. I think that everyone, I mean, my idea of what's great music is probably not yours, and probably not most other people, except the albums I'm going to put forward today as ones that absolutely you must know about, not because you need to listen to them forever or you should love them, but here's my criteria, and I think I gave it to you. For albums that this ultimately technical person podcast would recommend, so there'll be a particular kind of thing, but the rules for album choice is that number one rule is no filler tracks. I've written here.
That's a big call.
It's a very big call, but the great thing about that is that you can get rid of 99% of all albums.
Pretty much.
Yeah. So that's no filler. And by filler, I mean there's filler tracks that are quite catchy if you listen to them enough, but they're still childlike poppy crap, which shouldn't.
I'm curious, Andrew, by filler tracks, are you referring to Michael Jackson's lesser-known track, Filler?
That is hardly known at all. What album was that on? Don't Stop Till You Get to the Post Office? I can't remember.
Quincy Jones is cursing us from beyond now.
Yeah, that's a shame. I mean, as in, yeah, what a guy.
Indeed.
Acceptably listenable quality of a recording.
Mm-hmm.
So the definition there is that you put it on a hi-fi system and the audio fidelity doesn't make you cringe and want to turn it off. It doesn't mean it's audiophile quality engineering at all. It just means it just isn't fundamentally flawed like half of the Stones albums. And musically and songwriting, both, brilliant. Just have to be brilliant. Now, that would ultimately be someone's opinion, wouldn't it?
Of course.
This is where we run into the problem.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I've just said, this is music that you should know so that you can have a conversation about music from an educated point of view. Now, that's a bold statement, because there's so much music I don't know about.
Oh,
I shouldn't even be having this conversation, and that's kind of why I haven't done it.
Yeah.
So, good morning, David.
Good morning.
Tell me how you feel about those rules.
With the greatest of respect, I think they're guided, but they're arbitrary too, because the problem with music is it's an insanely personal thing.
It is. It's probably as personal as anything is, or correct, more so. More so? And why is it so personal? Is it because there's so much variety of it?
I think so. And at least, I think we touched on this a few episodes back, but certainly, maybe not so much now, but certainly a couple of decades ago, pre-internet, it was a bonding mechanism culturally where people shared various genres or indeed artists and said, oh, you know, this is my artist. And, oh, you know, kind of if you met someone who resonated with you, you went, oh, you're my buddy, you know, you like X, Y, Z. So there was something really visceral about that where you could have a conversation and you didn't have to explain because this other person actually got what this artist was doing, at least in your mind.
Yeah, well, that's right. And I think it's, in fact, I had thoughts, because I've been thinking about music the last couple of days because of this podcast and thinking about it rather than just listening to it, right? So one thought is that the taste thing is just simply taste. I mean, so there's some people like, you know, Ferraris, and some people like new Ferraris, and some people like old. And I'm going to guess that the people who like new Ferraris are younger people because they weren't there when the older ones came out, because that's the connection, isn't it? It's a time and a place thing. But then there's other people who like Dodge Rams, and these people will not be listening to the kind of music that I like. At least I believe that's the case.
I think there might be a correlation there.
Yeah. I think it's highly unlikely that Donald Fagen gets about in a Dodge Ram. But see, the embarrassing thing is he could very well. I mean, if he was a traditional musician, he would be driving something that almost doesn't run and is full of rust. But at least that was my upbringing in the music industry. So I did hang around with poor musicians, though. So I guess there's that, right? So if you like Jaguars, you probably, I don't know, you're going to like, I can't guess what you'd like, but it'll be something different than if you like Ford Falcons and you've got a particular fetish for XDs.
That may be true. I think there's some cultural strands that you could pull out of all this and say, a certain person who listens to this music will...
I just realised I can't eat an apple and talk on a microphone at the same time.
We'll drive
just
a certain car.
I'll put that piece of apple down. Do you think that's...
Oh, look, I don't know.
Someone who drives a Mercedes Estate...
Rather.
What does that have a bearing on what you... Because it's a good all-round vehicle. It makes a lot of sense. It's got a bit of style, but practical.
They are indeed.
You could load a decent-sized flat-screen TV in the back on its flat.
See, there's the pragmatism par excellence. I don't know. It's whimsical for us to sit here on a Sunday morning and speculate whether there is a correlation between musical styles and indeed cars. But I'd even go further to say that, you know, not just cars, but maybe other things. I don't know. I say that tongue-in-cheek. Who can say? We really don't know. But there's general cultural mythologies. I mean, if you go to a certain venue, XYZ, certainly when I was in the pro audio industry 20, 30 years ago, you would definitely meet a certain punter who would wear certain clothes and listen to certain music.
Yeah.
And that was very strong.
So then ultimately our suggestions are ultimately... The point of this conversation, this part of the conversation, is that, yeah, I mean, it's going to be personal preference.
Yeah, of course it is.
It's unavoidable.
Can't be anything else.
So on that basis, with that preface / get-out policy, ignore everything we say, except that for people who like, if I describe my taste as maybe the Ferrari Dino was the most beautiful car ever made, and I quite like Scotch whiskey, especially last night, apparently, and high-quality beer. Not so big a fan of wine. I like, I don't know, what do I like? I like pretty things. So
sounds like a line out of a movie.
Well, actually, taste in movies would be another... but then I like all kinds of movies. That's an interesting thing. When I think about movies, I think I'm happy to watch almost anything a gritty Australian, super slow-moving, typically Australian, great film that just moves carefully through the story versus, I don't know, something that's fast-moving and lots of jump cuts and, I don't know, I could enjoy that as well, like a, what's his name? You know, one of those American spy bullshit, or, you know, modern day version of a James Bond thing, which so I can't remember anything. You're going to go first.
Am I? Okay.
Yeah, because my selections are very pointedly mainstream.
Okay.
To the point where my suggestions are so mainstream that you simply have to know this album. And that's, people will go, oh, that's a load of crap, that album. But I've actually got second suggestions as well, just to, so you go, you can go first, unless you don't want to.
No, look, that's fine. And look, this, you know, gentle listener, these.
And what's your taste in stuff? What do you, just so you could preface that, well, so the music might align with.
Well, I've got a pretty Catholic taste. I mean, I literally listen to everything. There'll be only one or two subgenres I'm not really that keen on, but that's, you know, I'm not a big fan of metal. I probably don't understand it. About as close I've got to true, I don't know. See, we're treading on semantic thin ice here because everyone has these little things that they hold close to their breast about what this genre is all about. So if I start talking about Tool, some people will, you know, jump up and down and go, oh, that's not real metal. That's
not real metal because it's actually great music. So
that's... But you know what I mean. So, you know, I mean, I in one sentence I can talk about Shostakovich's Fifth, Scheherazade, and then anything from, say, Yellow or Kraftwerk or any kind of experimental noise artist out of Japan, and I like them equally because okay, so, they bring something to the table.
What's a noise artist? Is that like Bubbles or something?
Well, kind of. It's not as dismissive as that, but. But there's quite a few, and my stupid, look at this, a stupid thing hasn't updated. Yurikawa out of Japan does a great album called Spaces, and it's melodic. It's not just, you know, kind of, you know, trash cans and, you know, kind of sampling gone mad, you know, like other the old Music Concrete stuff that came out of Europe in the 60s. Very interesting album, very interesting album. I would recommend that. And not everyone's choice of music, and a lot of people don't even consider it music. I was once at a certain audio club at a certain part of the country, and I played it as a demo, and I got a few howls from the audience. That's not music.
This wouldn't have been in Melbourne, by any chance.
I'm not going to incriminate any capital city on the eastern seaboard, so there you go. So there's that, but I like, you know, I can listen to, you know, classic melodic stuff like, I don't know, Julie London from the 50s and 60s. But I also like, you know, mass orchestral stuff, you know, and heavy stuff like Shostakovich isn't exactly light listening. I mean, Stalin certainly assured that.
Yeah, somewhat heavy going.
It's somewhat heavy going, but it's intriguing. It's not something you can skip on. You know, there's this tendency now where everything's on playlists, whether it's on Tidal or Spotify or whatever, and you can go, no, I'm jack of that, next. And you know, we touched on this ages ago about the whole, the revival of vinyl. Is it kind of forces you to listen to an entire song?
Yeah, and I think that's, I've just set the rules down, and the rules are very album orientated. I mean, there has to be an album, and in the sense that, I guess, you know, musicians mostly build an album as a piece of work. You know, it goes together.
Yeah, there's
albums should be blown up, obviously, to use a good Ted Bullpittism. I'm just trying to think. There are scenarios where they do just whack songs together. I guess that call it the, you know, decade of so and so album. But I mean, that is ultimately a compilation as well. Sometimes they will revisit tracks and do live versions or whatever. I'm rambling.
That's all right.
So you're putting forward the.
I'm putting forward some performances and artists. I mean, albums themselves.
Album number one is the Japanese
noise? Well, it's a start. It's a start. And this is in no sequential order and everyone.
So specifically, because what we might do is we'll whack a playlist together on Tidal.
We'll do that when we finish and, so we'll get it all done.
Yes, okay. So check that out and that will be in the notes on the website.
That's one of the less commercial mainstream things I would. Yeah, if we're talking like as a friendly human-to-human thing, like, hey, you should listen to this. I'm not asking you to like it or even enjoy it. Just be aware of it because music can be this. But, you know, there's another album I think that is really overlooked unless you're a real David Byrne Talking Heads fan and certainly an Eno fan is the 1980 album My Life in the Bush of Ghosts that they did together. So you're squinting because you don't know it.
I don't know it. Do I know a single off it? There was no single. No.
It was by definition terribly uncommercial. But
it seems like they may have succeeded it. Sorry, David Byrne and
Brian Eno. You may have heard of Brian Eno. He's some obscure producer from the UK.
No, I know Brian Eno, but I mean anything he does is kind of very Brian Eno, isn't it? So
So that's interesting because sonically, texturally, and compositionally, it's really interesting stuff. You may not like it, but you can't call it boring or uninteresting.
No. Okay, that's good. So you've gone to. I'm going to hit you with two now.
Please.
Now, I mean these are. I'm embarrassed at how mainstream these choices are, but I feel like their albums. Okay, I listen to a lot of. I grew up with musicians in my life. And technical people and owners of a record store, etc. So I had, even though, of course, in the 70s when I became acquainted with music, of course, you know, there was clearly, you had to spend money to listen to music, which, or you put the radio on, but then that was a poor excuse. Clearly, you're only going to hear the singles. But I was in a lucky position of hearing a lot of music. So a lot of that music, probably 90% of it, I don't listen to anymore because it was kind of probably crap in its day. But I can have about 20 of these albums, by the way, but I've picked the best because, you know, of the exceptional songwriting, musicality, what have you. Without any further ado, I'm going to put forward the least well-known, I'm going to say Tears for Fears, The Seeds of Love, which I didn't become acquainted with as a child because it came out in 89. But it's not a perfect album, but it's an exceptional album, and it's completely overlooked. So we're sort of following on from your overlookedness. Everyone's heard of Shout, the single, and you know, Everyone Wants to Rule the World and all of that, but this is an exceptional piece of work. You do have to listen to it a bit to get into it, but it's as hooky as shit as actually all Tears for Fears stuff is. In fact, their new album, The Turning Point, I'm embarrassing myself now, but their new studio album, which came out a couple of years ago, is, and on first blush, kind of nothing really steps out at you and grabs you, but give it five listens and then all of a sudden it's just some songs on that are as catchy as shit. So that's a little bit, you know, I don't know. And look, 10 years before that, Ricky Lee Jones, her self-titled one, I haven't got some kind of stammer, exceptional songwriting, beautiful guitar playing, very stylish album. I still listen to that album a lot. Oh, no, I don't. I hardly ever listen to it. All of these albums I hardly listen to. But when I do, you are reminded, my God, this is brilliant work. This has not gotten old. Now, people will say, yeah, mate, but this shit's embedded in your head because, you know, you had a young, moldable brain and, you know, and...
well,
of course, that's true.
There's a modicum of truth to that.
There's tons of truth to that.
Yeah.
But later on in the show, I'm going to mention a couple of newer albums that I feel are also very, very good, and a couple of Australian ones because none of these choices are Australian artists. which is kind of embarrassing. But there's a lot of great Australian music, but I just...
A lot of it's buried, unfortunately.
Yeah, a lot of it's buried. A lot of it, unfortunately, doesn't quite have the polish. But generally, the songwriting is really first class. So so we'll get back to that. But so your turn again.
I'm glad we're doing this in kind of turns and throwing out a couple, because when you first gave me the brief about, albums that you think are... people should know about, I'm thinking, can I limit it to 200?
This is the problem. People are going to go, your choices are as boring. Yours are far more interesting choices. But yeah, the thing is, there's 200 albums. I mean, how many? There's probably 1,000 albums you've listened to that you know.
Easy.
You've got to whittle that down to five.
Well, it's impossible to whittle it down to five, but if you can indulge me, just give me a few minutes. I'll chuck a few albums from different genres that I think people should listen to.
Fire away.
And I'll try not to ramble on too much about each. You've got to listen to, I think it's a 1958 or 1959 recording of Scheherazade on Mercury Living Presence.
They make good recordings.
Oh, Lord above. I mean, this is at the very dawn of stereo recording.
Yeah, amazing recordings.
And how they got it right. They got it so right.
And the
thing is, too, it's not just, kind of like hats off to the quality of the recording at the time. Mm. We're talking way more than half a century ago. But the performance, geez, it's just alive. It's like someone opened up the gates of hell and out it all came.
Yep.
Amazing performance. Yes. Even if you're not a classical fan, I reckon that's an album you've got to listen to.
Yeah. Well, if that's on Tidal, and if it's not, we'll have a link to it. So any of these albums that we mentioned, which we may be glossing over a little bit ultimately, which is kind of silly in a way, we'll have listed on the webpage. Each episode of Not an Audiophile has its own page, and links will be on there. So continue, sir.
Thank you. Whilst we're on the topic of so-called classical music, Sheffield Labs, which was a label 10,000 years ago, used to cut what's known as direct-to-disc.
Now we're getting common ground. Because it's funny, when you said Mercury...
Living Presence,
Sheffield Lab immediately comes to mind just making the most lifelike recordings.
Yeah.
And there's Sheffield Lab bass. Can someone explain... It's where you actually hear kick drums. Like, there's never been a kick drum recorded. Whoever engineered those sessions, I know you're going to mention a classical, perhaps an orchestra, but, the kick has got... It sounds like a kick drum
does. It's got real body.
Yeah, it's got some thwack and some body, and it's, yeah.
Well, if you've heard the Thelma Houston pressure cooker album that they released...
Yeah, I have heard that album, yes.
I mean, there's old folklore that goes back on its release after it got cut and everything. Unfortunately, whether this is true or not, I don't know. It's a great urban myth, though. Unfortunately, the mixing console was overdriven, and there was, shall we say, more than a tinge of THD in the recording.
Yes, yes.
But it works. I mean, it's exceptional recording, so who cares?
Oh, it's so is that one of your albums?
No.
Okay. Well,
the one I was going to mention is Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
It is.
On Sheffield Lab.
Oh, Lord above. It is without doubt in my mind the most realistic rendition of that piece I've ever heard. I mean, you are literally there. I know this sounds like such an audiophile wank, but you are there. You are literally there on a high resolving system with good dynamic range and good imaging.
Mm-hmm.
Man alive, you're there. And for those listeners who don't know what direct-to-disc was, very briefly, it's a way of cutting records that bypasses any kind of intermediary stage like mastering to digital or mastering to hard drive or certainly mastering to two-channel open reel tape. What they did was they actually had a cutter, a lathe, in the adjacent room and fed the mics directly to the lathe.
Yep.
I mean, you think about that as a commercial proposition. If someone dropped their bow or coughed, you throw away that master and you start again.
The great thing is... So basically microphones, mixing desk, two channel mix, obviously, stereo mix, straight to the
cutting lathe.
Yeah, I was gonna say to the lacquer, but There's two advantages to that. One is obviously amazing sound, but the other one is it's a live performance.
True enough.
And on a number of Sheffield recordings, there is a few taps and there's I don't know which album, but there's someone drops something and there is a cough somewhere else. But that's that could be said of all live performances. Live performances are almost always better, right?
Yeah.
But I think modern live performances are very often cut together from pieces of live performances and probably heavily edited for stuff, but all kinds of things that the engineer slash producer may see or hear as a fault, not the Sheffield Labs. And so they made two-track, I don't know what tape machine, but a premium, a very high-quality tape machine. They ran that as a backup as which is how they made the CDs, if people are wondering. No, the CDs are not rips of a record.
Yeah.
They lose a bit of snap, don't they, if you listen to the disc compared with the record.
They do, and it's confounding. Probably someone out there's got a real technical reason as to why. I don't know. But honestly, on a decent turntable, that disc is just it's
alive.
It's alive, and it makes you happy to be alive. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's one of those moments where it can sound this good, huh?
Well, actually, that's kind of part of my. It's funny, the two albums that I've mentioned. I was going to say, kind of part of my rules with my five choices is that it's happy music. It makes you happy. It's not Nick Cave. And as talented and as wonderful as he is, we won't go there. The point is, but Ricky Lee Jones, actually, that album is happy.
It is.
But later albums, less happy. She was just getting a start. She was
they
happy.
All go that way, Andrew.
Yes, that's right. Tears for Fears, happy at times, very serious though. They're very serious fellows and write songs about serious stuff. So less happy. My other three choices, I think, are happier. Maybe not. That was Sheffield Labs.
Romeo and Juliet.
Romeo and Juliet, that's right, yes. Yeah. Which I have listened to actually a long time ago. I have not listened to it recently. Was that two? That was two, wasn't it?
That was two. As I say, I'm really trying to restrain myself, but I think later on, if we could, we can talk about music at shows and music in...
we're going to, we should have sold that at the start to keep people hanging. There's actually, we want to talk briefly, we're going to have two tracks that we both use for a tool, if you like.
I guess,
a tool, as a tuning tool or a testing tool. And the other thing is, we are going to discuss music and hi-fi shows. I've got here Crime of the Century, obviously, Supertramp. 1974, not a perfect album, super mainstream choice. Not as mainstream as Breakfast in America, which I just actually don't listen to anymore. It's aged poorly, in my opinion. It was more of a, I guess it was a more successful album. I think they did have, that was a big hit. Crime of the Century draws a nice balance between their kookier stuff, more super trampy stuff, and I guess pop music, but it's a pretty serious album. I guess there's some pretty sad songs in there, but it makes you happy. You're looking at me like have some imagination, but at the same time, there'll be music playing under this, which we're clearly not playing at the moment because I think I can get away with it copyright-wise. I'm going to have it at a low level, very short snippets, and then probably not load this episode on YouTube.
Yeah, well, yeah, definitely not.
Spotify hopefully won't catch it either, but we'll see. So, yes, yeah, so you should be hearing snippets underneath us blithering. Okay. I'm not going to say Rumours. Because
you just did.
Because it's a fantastic album. It's look, remember, I've got to keep prefacing. These are albums that it's not that you haven't heard of them. Your albums people haven't heard of. These are albums you've heard of, which you've gone, that's old people's music. I'm not listening to it. You need to listen to it. All right. But Rumours, if you like Rumours, the album that I actually I'm putting forward is the self-titled one they made 2 years earlier, which is the first of the new Fleetwood Mac sound, and is I think it's 97% as good as Rumours. In fact, I'm not even sure if it's not the other way around. Fleetwood Mac, another self-titled. The first albums are often the best. clearly, the third album of the new band, Tusk, has a couple of good tracks on it. But even those good tracks are not in the league of these two albums. So, in my opinion, other people love Tusk. I mean, Tusk, great piece of work. They had all the money in the world, all of the equipment in the world, and all of the time in the world, they turned out a pile of shit. So, whereas Rumours was, as everyone knows, made in a certain amount of domestic stress environment, and yet astounding. And so, part of this is not just the songwriting; it's the way it was played, the way it was recorded. It captured a moment. In this case, I mean, you know, it's that initial change of style of Fleetwood Mac, the input of Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham, and what that brought to the rather staid, well, I mean, it's completely different to the original band. I don't know why they didn't change the name of the band, really. But all of these choices of mine are just it's a bit of a... It was a time when there was really no punching stuff done much. It's a more live sounding recording, and also actual musicians, brilliant musicians, playing their instruments brilliantly at the height of their powers, I think is, you know, part of it as well.
Sure, I'd agree. Yeah.
So, which brings us to your fifth choice. Not that we're stuck to five necessarily.
No. Yeah, as I say, I could do 100. I really could, but I'll if you'll indulge me, I will just do.
I will
do,
indulge you.
Oh, bless you, brother.
Feel be indulged. I'm sorry, indulge yourself. Let us be indulged
in just
with your indulgences. Get on with it.
All right, I've got the mic now. Here we go.
We've only got one microphone, people. We
dance around the studio wildly.
Yeah, those yoga microphones are incredibly expensive.
Travelling on from the classic stuff that I mentioned, this is kind of not really classic, but it's interesting. I imagine a lot of you have heard of Keith Jarrett, pianist. In 1976...
A very unkind thing to say.
What?
Keith Jarrett, the penis. What? I mean, it's... I mean,
well, he's a penis.
He was
come
a bit
on.
Of a knob.
He's a really accomplished keyboard player. What would you like me to call
pianist.
Him?
Oh, pianist.
No, boom, boom.
Well, this is the old part show.
Oh, wow. I've got a million of them.
Edit that shit out.
Yes, a man who tinkles the ivories.
Very effectively.
Anyway, in 1976, after the success of the Clon concert, which was his standout album, I think, it's very not as well known. He did a series of albums as he toured Japan called the Sun Bear Concerts.
Okay.
And a lot of the performances, I don't think, are that terribly remarkable. However, he did an encore in Tokyo, and it goes, I think it goes for a little more than 10 minutes. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But it is it's all ad hoc. He just improvises from the get-go.
Okay.
And it is the most astonishing piece of piano music I've heard in my life.
All right, I'm going to check that out.
It is beautiful. If it's the most emotional thing I think has been played on a keyboard, and that's just totally subjective, I get it. But do yourself a favour and listen to it. It's quite astonishing.
Will do, Molly. okay.
So
we're going to have a link to a version. Is there a version? Is the album that contains that encore on Tidal?
Yeah, it is. You look under Sun Bear Concerts, and I think it was a 5 or 6 vinyl box at the time, but it is on Tidal. I'll find it and we'll put the link up there, but it's definitely on Tidal. It's the Tokyo Encore. It is truly a thing of magnificence.
Okay, thank you. If you're awake out there still, I've got my lucky last. Look, Steely Dan is a problem. It's inappropriate to be a fan. Actually, it's inappropriate to be a fan of like Billy Joel. What happened to Billy Joel? Somewhere along the line, everyone decided that they needed to hate Billy Joel. It would be fashionable. And I'm not a lover of Billy Joel, but that's unfair. Steely Dan went through a bad phase. A lot of people implied you lacked imagination.
There was a lot of sneering going on in the audio community, yeah.
I keep coming back to it. I'm sorry. It's just, it's all of their stuff is great, in my opinion. I'm a fan. I'll just admit it, all right? And when I say I'm a fan, I wasn't sure I was a fan. I have listened. This list today would imply I only listen to big bands and their hit albums, but I listen to all kinds of music, I do. And even country music. So,
and Western.
Not so much the Western. I just keep coming back. It's fun, it's happy, it's hooky. Of course, beautifully played by the best musicians that probably... Why is my computer? I'll just do that to that, because that's an unnecessary racket from the fan. The band turned into a sort of a session band, basically. Walter and Donald just hiring in the very best. So there's an attraction there because I did grow up with that, you know, West Coast session muso kind of, you know, I was attracted to that, I guess. Also attracted to a lot of Australian music, which we're going to touch on briefly. Yeah. But there is no Australian band that can compete with the perfection of Ajar, however you want to pronounce it, AJA. It's a perfect album. And if you're not familiar with it and you don't hate rock, pop, jazz, then you should know it. And it does take a bit of getting to know. I think it's a less easy album to get into than, say, Gaucho, which is, of course, you know, excellent in its own way. And then the earlier albums, which are the more rocky sort of albums, different lineup, the actual, you know, the original band to some degree, are a lot of fun and great albums. The lineup still changed from every album, I think. But the point is that perfection occurred with Asia in 1977, which is a bloody long time ago. It's getting up for 50 years, isn't it? Is it? Oh, my God, it is. That's scary. But I would add to to this choice in particular, you know, Two Against Nature, 2000, much newer music, different take, still somewhat light-hearted approach to the songwriting and the seriousness of it all. And, I think that's an album you could probably listen to as well. It's quite a lot of fun. And the great thing is, with Two Against Nature, is it will show off your stereo system. Because Ajar's a bit... Well, I was talking to someone about tape machines the other day, but I noticed there was a YouTube video on tape machines. So obviously YouTube heard me talking to the person about tape machines, and then it starts serving up videos about analog production. And there's a guy on there going about the biggest problem with analog multitrack was that the more you fucked with it, the more you played the tape, the more you punched shit in and added to it. And, you know, and obviously if you were building a tune with a couple of guys and you were doing lots of multitracking, you know, lots of rewinding, lots of playback and recording, you ended up, all the oxide fell off the tape.
Yeah, no shit.
And so that's why I think albums like Dark Side of the Moon, there you go, I mentioned it, any of the early Fleetwood, any of that 70s, you know, carefully made music sounds a bit, I wouldn't use the word muddy, but a bit overly analog, I would say. It lacks a certain spark.
Yeah.
And I guess that's unavoidable, that you've, the oxide has literally taken the top end with it as it, you know, as it built up on the Pinterolla capstan heads, etc. So, I mean, you know, I'd sound unexcited about these albums, but they're five brilliant albums. And then the adjunct is, like I say, Two Against Nature. The other one is Tears of Fears, Seeds of Love, but there's the new album, Tipping Point. Supertramp, there's no new album. there is actually a newer album, which is surprisingly good. Done just by one of the guys, because the other, they don't talk much anymore. And of course, then as far as Fleetwood Mac, there was The Dance as far as newer albums, which is probably one of the greatest live albums ever. So what other stuff did you want to, because the new way, by the way, of recording Not an Audiophile, the podcast, is to not have ad breaks engineered into it. We're just talking for an hour.
Okay.
And I just slam them in there like some kind of traffic report ad. Roll straight into...
With the helicopter noise behind you?
No helicopter noises, but the same sort of, you know, the M1's looking busy from so-and-so Tanamera up to the CBD. Have you been to the Yatla pie shop lately? Pies are half price this week. You know, the way they just roll into...
Yeah, I know. And it always amuses me when, unironically, they'll be floating above a metropolis saying, you know, traffic on the Western freeways, blah, blah, blah. And ICE insurance for your... It's just like, holy shitburgers, you know. Okay, right.
Whatever. I mean, it is a particular style.
It is.
I quite like it because it's over. The ad is over before you've really noticed you're listening to an ad, which is the best kind of ad.
Correct.
So other musical... Now, are we talking musical choices, like just general stuff that you're recommending, or is this, are we talking about tracks now that you can engineer by, so to speak?
Yeah, look, I think so. If I can just... Look, I know time's getting on and half of our audience have fallen asleep already.
Jeff from Hey Now Hi-Fi sells really good hi-fi that you can't get everywhere, both online and in store. You may be interested or you may not. If so, check out his website. That's heynowhifi.com.au. That's heynowhifi.com.au. So, fire away. What do you got there?
Okay. Again, in no particular order, and it's totally subjective, but there's some tracks I think that you should play on a decent stereo system to hear what it can do. In no particular order, Mick Kahn, who used to be the bass player in the band Japan from the 80s.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
His debut album, which was never replicated in terms of brilliance. We're talking about debut albums, etc. before.
Mm.
The opening track called Tribal Dawn is some of the most outstanding bass playing I've ever heard, and it is a test for a system.
Okay.
Real test for a system in terms of how it renders the harmonics of the bass guitar.
Yep.
And how fast and snappy the system is. It's a tour de force.
Okay.
That I'd recommend. What else? I'd recommend the second recording of Philip Glass's Koyaanisqatsi, Scotsy, the one that Michael Reisman engineered. I think it's 1999, 2000. It was just on the cusp of when DVD-A was coming out.
Mm-hmm.
We've all forgotten DVD-A. But it's available on CD. And the opening organ pedals is 32-foot notes and 64-foot notes on there. It's like, you know, look out. The bass is Leviathan, but...
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, really, really good test for a well-calibrated system in its bass. And wildly
keen to
atmospheric,
hear that. Yeah,
too.
Okay. And I may have heard that, actually, but I'm going to check that out.
Yeah.
I'm going to check them all out, but I mean, you know.
Oh, look, there's so much.
It's a matter of which one am I going to check out first.
You know, the problem is when you kind of thrust this thing upon me saying, oh, yeah, give them what you think you should play, there's so many good things. I mean, I guess, and I don't want to kind of segue directly now, but this goes to what we were talking about before off mic about how at shows we hear the same old stuff all the bloody time.
Mm.
And there's such a surfeit of really good music since 1980 that for some reason doesn't get played at shows.
Okay, the whole show thing, what is it with high-end, like proper high-end manufacturers who play kooky, slow-moving, literally music created to, in their mind, show off some aspect of the performance of the system. This is classic audiophile trash music. This is not music. I mean, it's worse than the shit that Name made on their label, which is pretty awful, but, you know, kind of well-recorded in a Name kind of way. But
Are you suggesting it's well-recorded, boring music?
It's mediocrely well-recorded non-music. I mean, There's music that's just so... It's not AI, but it's like great musicians doing their worst work kind of thing. It's a bit hard to... I've heard it.
I know what
everyone knows what I'm talking about. Yeah. I can't think... I don't know the name of the track because, A, I can't work Shazam for some reason. My phone's got a problem with it. And secondly, I don't think these tracks are on the Shazam database because it's not music. Yeah, like, it doesn't even have a rhythm. Like, it's... There was one thing, and I'm going to get... Kiet Lowe, the Duntech designer, manufacturer, slash owner, slash whatever. He's clearly not the only designer on the team, you know, but Kiet's a great guy, known him for years, blah, blah, blah. But the point is, he, at a show, had his giant Duntech playing this thing called Sharpen Your Knife or something. I don't know the track. No one knows the track. It was that lyric over and over again, and it was so obviously recorded with outrageous amounts of sibilance and shit on it. Sibilance. It was just horrible. I just wanted to walk away. He was impressed. Sorry, Kit, but I want to ask you who that woman was and make sure that I can delete her from my internet so that I never accidentally... I mean, that's just rubbish. Come on, mate, you can do better. You could have played anything. The best demo, in my opinion, is to play the music that people know.
Funny that.
Yeah. Now, so playing Fleetwood Mac then is the best demo, if you've genuinely got a product, because everyone knows it. And that's a terrible demo at the same time because it's engineering-wise not really a tour de force, but I, you know, I'll pay, you know, Dire Straits, you know, like there's another great album, but, you know, it doesn't quite fulfill the criteria and it all sounds the same, but it's a great album. I mean, you play Six Blade Knife and if you've got a genuinely good system, people may be hearing it in a way they've never heard it so good before.
No,
that's a great demo.
That's
what isn't a great demo is fucking Diana Krall, who... He's very talented, not as talented as her husband,
I'm not going there.
No. I mean, come on. But Diana Krall's not even the problem, is it? It's worse stuff than that.
No, there's heaps worse than Diana Krall, and no disrespect to Ms. Krall or the lovers of her music. But I just find it really asinine sometimes when I go to shows around the world, and this was even... back in the day when I was going to AES shows in Las Vegas, when they would be playing stuff, you know, not consumer-oriented, and it would be, why are you playing this? This is the most dull, nonsensical stuff I've heard.
It's always slow-moving, very light on the instrumentation.
Oh, yeah, no. You wouldn't want to challenge a system, heavens.
No, and so I get why they do it.
Oh, yeah.
But they're failing. Anyhow, so what would you play at a hi-fi show, David?
That's an unfair question.
Would you do what I do and just play yellow tracks all day?
It's funny you should say that because the buggers have been around for close on half a century now. That's scary.
Mm.
And I reckon Boris Blank is one of the most underrated producers around. I mean, he did an album with Malia a few years back, and I've noticed that's been doing the rounds of hi-fi shows with tracks like Fever and you know, Celestial Voices, I think, is the first track. And it's just beautiful.
That's the one I used.
Yeah, well, it's like Sonic Honey. You sit in front of it and you just can't not be entranced by it. It's so beautiful.
So speaking of engineering quality, I mean, how do they – is it just a Swiss thing? But how do they –
How is it so transcendentally superior from an audio engineering point of view to just about everything else that's made? I mean, if people are like, well, what's a proper engineered album? Like, what's something? None of this shit that you've said is any good. Sounds like mud. Put some yellow on. Yeah. But the thing is, musically, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
They do have a couple of tropes that they're kind of stuck on, but it's very likable. Once again, a bit like Steely Dan, it's kind of fun. You know, there's not a lot of sad tracks.
Well, no, I'd look, you know, getting back and, you know, I know we're kind of evoking, you know, memories from last century, but I remember as a young man listening to what was one of my first true hi-fi systems. It was a certain dealer in Sydney. And we had it was a pair of Acoustic Energy AE1s, the original with the spun aluminium cone.
Yes.
With a pair of Jeff Roland monoblocks, which I subsequently bought along with the AE1s, playing Yellow The Race, which I think was from 1986. And it was on vinyl at the time, and it was the most alive, rippling fun. It was fun. I had a smile on my face. And I mean, if music and a system can do that, isn't that what we're after?
I think so. I'm continually surprised that people don't know what Yellow is. I mean, I thought, kind of got them there.
I have to invoke, you know, kind of Ferris Bueller's Day Off every time I
and
play.
Three or four other movies that they use it in, if not. And, of course, it's now used like you'd put it into, I think it actually is in a...
It's in some ads.
And it's in ads, but it's also in like, is it in National Lampoon Vacation movies, one of them.
That's
just
right.
Where they're trying to evoke a Ferris Bueller-y type thing. Yeah. Yellow. Wow. You know, just and it doesn't matter which album. And bizarrely, they were always well engineered.
Oh, brilliantly!
Used to use the one with Blender on it, Baby. Used to use that for demo in its day, and now it sounds a bit muddy. The new ones are so transparently, beautifully
gorgeous.
Made.
Gorgeous.
Oh, crikey! You know, I still good music.
Yeah.
In fact, I think better.
Yeah.
It's one of the few artists that I actually think. Except for maybe the originality of things like The Race and I think they kind of got better, I think, mostly. So you're a fan, obviously.
Yeah, I just respect them immensely. They've got a level of musicality that I could never achieve and a level of engineering that I could never achieve, and I enjoy them immensely.
I think there's some very expensive equipment involved.
Oh, there is.
I think they just simply have the best.
Yeah, well, they're cashed up. I remember... they bought one of the first Fairlight series, CMI series 3s, in the mid-80s.
Well,
and they were doing a lot of this.
$100,000
one, isn't it? Oh, yeah. That was like, you know.
$100,000 US, that is.
Yeah, but the series 3 was an amazing sounding machine.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could talk to you about the Fairlight and the sound. I just wonder how good the sound was. But it did sound good, did it, the series, by the time we got to series 3?
I mean, you probably covered this with the interview with Kim before, but the Fairlight Series 2X was...
We didn't pin him down on how good it sounded because...
Well, there were two iterations of it, really. There was a before and after kind of series. The Series 2X, which everyone mythologized in the pro audio synth community, only a few hundred were ever made, and they used a special 8-bit, I think it was a companion system that they used, but it had a real quality. Mm. It wasn't by any stretch of the imagination accurate, whereas the 3 was accurate, had ultra-high sample rates, and the cards that they made for each voice channel were just engineered to the hilt, and that's probably why they went broke, because they over-engineered the Series 3.
Yeah, you couldn't really charge enough for that stuff in the day, in the sense of, you know, the hardware cost money.
No, it was serious money, and made in Australia, no less.
Yeah, which... So, on that note, made in Australia music. Australian music. Have you got anything that... I've got some great mainstream choices.
Well, I don't know. Mine's pretty mainstream too. It all depends how you define mainstream. But I thought virtually all the stuff that The Reels did in the 80s, I really enjoyed. Especially the album called The Reels on KTEL,
Were you in The Reels? You look like you could have been...
Yeah, seriously.
What was the name of the key lead singer?
God, isn't it terrible?
He did have a particular appearance. You don't look like that at all.
No,
but,
no, thanks. I'm not that tall and skinny. However, I do remember seeing them at a venue in Fortitude Valley in Brisbane, and I was just a very, very young person. And I looked at them from afar on stage, and I noticed the keyboard player, I've forgotten what her name was, she was playing a role in Jupiter 8. And my first thought was, wow, these guys must be rich. That's how naive I was.
I've thought about this quite a bit. Like, and I've thought about this from the point of view, okay, you haven't got any Australian albums. What's the best Australian album ever? Some people would jump to AC/DC and Back in Black. I wouldn't. But before I say what my best is, you know what, I've got an album here that I really like.
What's
it
that?
Was made in 2021.
Okay.
Pookie Flick. Flick is the album's name with a capital FL, lowercase ICK. There'll be a link, of course. Pookie is the band / artist. You need to have a listen to that album. It's really fucking good. So I'm not stuck on old music. I just have mentioned old. It's okay. It's not as perfect as a Steely Dan production. But it's really well made.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, she's a very good artist. Interesting voice. I think she wrote everything. And look, I guess why I like it is that they keep falling back into some kind of jazz fusion-y sort of.
That was my next question. What genre?
Yeah, sort of full. It's R&B or soul or something, but then or modern or rap, right? But it flops back during many of the tunes into sort of the music that I'm comfortable with.
Well, it's funny you should say that.
A new take on it and a very nicely played one, you know.
Well, Bad Segue is another band I like out of Canberra. It's Safia, S-A-F-I-A.
I think I've heard of that.
Australian band. The guy does like a falsetto that's worthy of Marvin Gaye. Really excellent band and beautiful musicianship too, so I'd recommend any of Safia's work.
Yeah, I think I've heard of the album. Heard of the band, sorry. Look, I've re-listened to a couple of albums briefly this morning and yesterday, just skimmed through them and gone, I'm just going to say Cold Chisel East. I know that's, a bit fucked out, but, neither of us will have listened to it forever. Sorry, I just whacked the mic stand. Neither of us will have, probably listened to the album in completion for a lifetime or ever. It's a really good album, you know. There's lots of other really good albums that are nearly as good as that, or maybe they are as good, but it's just one that it's... what a band. Don Walker, songwriting, playing. Jimmy, of course, was in much better form in those days than he currently is. He decided not to shout as much back then. He did at live gigs, but I went to one once and he was out of control. And although it was not Cold Chisel, it was there was a band that was a rolling lineup that they Playboys or something.
Okay.
Richard Clapton, James Rain, bunch of other people just rolling through, and they. I'm rambling, but that was, I don't think there's any albums, there's no recordings, it was just a live, remember live music? It's a thing that you used to go to, which has kind of come back, thank God, but in a different way, it's just not pub rock like, the day.
Now you've got to make room for the poker machines, I'm afraid.
That's right. Once again, an unimaginative choice. But if you like Australian music and you are not familiar with Cold Chisel East, Cold Chisel the band, East the album, you're going to love it. If you like, lively, slightly edgy, but not that edgy, guitar-driven.
It's rock.
Rock.
Yeah.
It's more rock than... There's a few ballads in there. They're great. Of course, there's the classic Oita. What do you got? Australian music. Anything other than Safia?
I haven't listened to them for a while, but I really enjoyed a lot of Hunters and Collectors' work.
Mm.
It was very interesting music, beautiful polyrhythms, well recorded, and just clever music.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, there's actually tons and tons of great Australian music, and it's just that it is all sounds like Australian music, and it's like it's a bit like the Barrier Reef, and you live on it. Doesn't mean you ever go to it. It's there. It's one of those weird things. You go to Egypt instead to see the pyramids or something. Yeah. It's one of those. You go to a lot of trouble to go to the pyramids. You could just get on a boat. I lived next to the Barrier Reef for a lot of my life, and I never went. But I went to other parts of the Barrier Reef that were 1,000 kilometres away.
Oh, the irony.
So what is that? I don't know what that is. Yeah. So it's a bit like that with Australian music. I think so much good stuff. But I wanted to mention some new stuff, and there's a lot of good new music. None of it was made by Taylor Swift. Just my opinion, but that doesn't mean that she's not successful. So maybe there's a whole generation of people who in 50 years' time are going to ramble on about the magic of Taylor Swift. It's as unbelievable as how houses have gone from being $23,000 to $2 million. So, I mean, it is so could happen, right? And on that note... Oh, was there something else we were going to say?
I think that's pretty much covered it. That's certainly within the scope of an hour. But no, we can extend this. But
well, we did have the. I wanted to mention the track that I use I'm going to have to Google it. That I use for testing. Okay, so there's tracks when you're designing a speaker, or you're repairing a speaker, or there's. There's some music, as we know, there's certain tracks that just are very difficult to reproduce nicely. Quite often, female vocals, of course. The female voice is a fragile, delicate instrument and is quite hard sometimes. Any Ricky Lee Jones is a system tester. Her voice is bordering on unpleasant most of the time. If there's problems in the mid-range, they'll be exposed. But there's another track here. Which I'm just looking up.
Are you a vinyl lover looking for your next great find? Wax Lyrical is the record club for music enthusiasts, delivering hand-picked albums every month. We don't just send records, we give you the full experience, complete with exclusive listening notes and a community of like-minded music fans. Whether it's a hidden gem or a classic masterpiece, you'll discover something new to love. Join Wax Lyrical today and keep the music spinning. Hit Wax, that's with a XX, lyrical.com for more information.
Okay, so we're back at Not an Audiophile episode, God knows what. We here with David Carrazza, assisting with boring you with our musical suggestions. Not something we'll do again in a rush, because people will write in and say, please stop. But especially when you can't think of the name of the actual track that you... No, there's this beautifully recorded... somewhat audiophile sounding track. It will be in the notes. Sorry, folks. I'm going to tell you what the track is, because it's called The One You Love, and it's Meave Maeve or whatever, and I can't remember. It's M-E-A-V, M-A-E-V, M-X-Y-Z-V. I can't remember how to spell the poor woman's name. She has a glass-like vocal sounding, both style and sounding voice. And if you are having trouble listening to that on your system, get a better system. I used it developing the last design that I did, the 70S. It was sounding good in the mid-range, I thought. I was comparing it with other things like I do, and, you know, and going, oh, this is pretty bloody good. Quite revealing, you know. Took them home. Put this track on, went, all right, put them back in the car, take them back to work. Just, it unearthed this hidden, just, there was a, it just went, not much, not bad, but it was bad. Like, it was like, you couldn't listen to it, right?
Right.
That track will unearth weird resonances, peaks, colorations in the mid, the somewhere in the, I mean, there's harmonics there. It's hard to know exactly. Somewhere between 200 and 2,000, really. The whole, I don't even know where the problem was because I've forgotten. But the higher end of that range. But I rectified it. I brought them home and we played the same track again, and the problem went away, and the track sounded beautiful. So, prop job done. But yes, very good track for unearthing issues in the mid. And that's all I've got because I've forgotten what the other track is. So have you got one that you, like if you go out and put a system together for someone, because I always used to, when I did that, I always used to like to play something that I knew well, I had a good oral memory of, just to give myself a benchmark the system and know which way to go with it.
Look, there's probably a couple.
Where to move the speakers or whatever.
Yeah, there's probably a couple. I mean, certainly there's one or two Boris Blank tracks that I use and, you know, that'll...
But that's cheating though, isn't it, really?
Well, why is it cheating?
Because it's so beautifully recorded and made, it will sound good on more systems. That's what I feel. I feel like it's got to be... it's almost like... So I mentioned the Stones and their scrappy recordings, but in fact...
Yep.
Their stuff sounds better on a better system that's more revealing and then that's more accurate as well. And then you understand how the recording ended up being the way it was. You thought it was crap. So this is going two ways. So I'm saying Yellow can sound good, or Jennifer Warnes or something can sound good on almost anything. On the other hand, I think the Stones sounds bad on most things until you get to a more serious system.
Okay.
That's got balance and... lack of distortion and lack of coloration. Do you think, or you're not?
Well, yeah, I don't know. Look, there's a problem with a lot of recordings in the 60s and the 70s, and that's not to say that all contemporary recordings are great, because they're not. But one thing I find is when people come in and they listen to a system, they'll be brandishing their favorite Stones or Led Zeppelin album or what have you,
yep.
And you put it on and it sounds really naff.
Yeah,
like it sounds like a wet paper bag pretending to be a kick drum,
yep.
And and you just sit there and you just go, oh,
it's dull and lifeless, it's dirty.
Well,
it's...
yeah, but I mean, some of them are disappointed, some of them are happy. But the thing is, back in the day, there wasn't that culture of high end audio at home, and so as you know, the companies. No. Engineered the system to sound the tracks, I should say, to sound good on a transistor radio out at the beach or home or whatever. It wasn't engineered for hi-fi.
Yeah, and some just wasn't engineered. We could talk about the naffest recordings ever.
Mm.
Is there one that springs to mind?
Gosh. No, I don't want to be pilloried for this. No, I'm going to not. There's a few from the 60s and the early 70s.
Well, Led Zeppelin.
I just run out of the room screaming, thinking, how on earth can you listen to this?
I'm trying to think what. We all know, anyone who's worked in hi-fi retail knows there's a double-edged sword with the customer that brings in their favorite track.
Sure.
Because if the system you're playing is any good and is to their taste, they will never have heard the track sound so good, and they will love it. You'll be standing in the corner with your arms crossed going, my God, that's the worst I've heard that sound. But it doesn't matter because it actually sounds better on their music.
Correct.
But on the other hand, there is that sinking feeling where you're like, well, we're not going to be showing off the best aspects of this $50,000 system or this $5,000 system with that piece of crap. So, and then there's the people who just bring in bad music. I mean,
there's that, regardless of the engineering qualities.
There's bad music. But is there bad music? Yes, there is. Yeah, but that's another episode, I guess. Quite often the people who make bad music... like really nice people. I think that's what I wanted to say.
Good. Keep the lawyers at bay, right?
There's no lawyers. For lawyers, there's got to be listeners. People have got to complain. Hey, thank you, everybody, for listening in. I know we rambled. I know normally we don't do that. But we got there in the end. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
We will see you again in the near future.
Absolutely.
I think the next episode or two are probably inventors of some kind, designers or what have you, but you will be back. So thanks again. Thanks, folks, for listening, and we'll see you next time.